Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. My name is Jeff Mulgan. This is the third of a series of lectures we're having to accompany the launch of the Young Foundation. Since I hope you will all picked up a sort of short leaflet on what we're doing, I won't say any more about the Young Foundation, though I will do two short sales pitches. One is, if you are a social scientist, and I think there are probably quite a lot of social scientists here, please do take a copy of this leaflet, which describes the Michael Young Prize, which we've launched with the Economic and Social Research Council, and which could be a way for you to win some money and some help with various things. So please do take it if you think the work you're doing is of interest and potentially having an impact on the society you're all in. And the second pitch is a book which we have just reprinted about Michael Young. And if you are interested in social change, how ideas become reality, I will strongly recommend this, which describes how a whole host of things in education and health and community made the transition from being gleams in someone's eye into changing the lives of millions of people all over the world. So some handy hints there, and this is on sale outside the lecture after we finished. If any of you were unable to get tickets for the last two lectures, which did sell out some time in advance, there will be MP3 files of them on the Young Foundation website in a few days' time. Charles Tilley on 9/11 and how we explain phenomena, and last week Tariq Ramadan on the place of Islam in non-Islamic societies. We're very delighted to have Ali Hochschild here to give the third of our lectures. I suspect many of you will be very familiar with her work, a series of trailblazing books, The Time Bind, The Commercialization of Intimate Life, which she's going to be talking about this evening, and Global Woman, all available on Amazon and all very good value. And you can buy them all when you get home and log on. And in a way, these are sort of like the previous two lectures. We've been trying to get different angles on what's happening to everyday life, what's happening to society, what's happening to change, perhaps a little bit beneath the radar of the sort of traditional mainstream accounts which you'll get in the newspapers and magazines and on television. And perhaps the issues we're going to be talking about this evening, even more than any others, are the ones where social science intersects with the most personal, intimate choices, conversations in bedrooms and kitchens up and down the country. And they're all perhaps issues, ambiguities, which we all live with in different ways. Ali is going to speak to us for 45, 50 minutes, and then I hope we'll have plenty of time for questions and discussions. And my only plea would be, don't take any notice of the LSE clock there, which says it is 2:35. For some reason, this university, perhaps like other universities, exists in its own slight time zone apart from the rest of the world. So, Ali, over to you.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Jenny Russell, for arranging this. It's my very great pleasure to be here. So, as a point of departure, we can perhaps start with certain startling glimpses into recent newspaper accounts of what I'd like to call the commercial edge of intimate life. We don't have far to look. In the August issue, just last month, of Esquire magazine, features a man, actually an editor-at-large at Esquire, who for a month outsourced his life to India. Everything from ordering food to fighting with his wife went to a cheerful woman named Honey in Bangalore. Honey answered Mr. Jacob's emails. She made telephone calls for him. She ordered his groceries. She bought his movie tickets. She wrote an apology to his wife, who was angry about something he'd forgotten. That did not go over very well with his wife. And by the end, he said, quote, "They were reading my son bedtime stories." So his personal assistant was working 8 hours a day, and this cost him $1,000 a month. And he paid a firm called Your Man in India $500 a month. This would be roughly like 800 pounds, 400 pounds, I guess, for 4 hours of work a day. This is on the Wall Street Journal, August 10. So moment one. Moment two, you're just reading the newspapers. This is, you don't have far to go. International Herald Tribune tells of a new agency called Growing Stars, which hires Indian tutors in Cochin, Kerala, where my husband and I were 6 years ago as Fulbright scholars, to 10-year-old children to do homework over the internet. Now, international outsourcing really takes abroad what has already been outsourced domestically. And for example, answering email and purchasing tickets and tutoring and the like. So, and sometimes what is outsourced is an activity which in yesteryears a parent might do, a bedtime story, or a husband might do, apology to his wife, or a housewife of the 1950s might do, get a theater ticket. And sometimes what's outsourced is something like one might have done for oneself, like, for example, losing weight. One man, in a recent New York Times article, told of hiring a personal trainer who helped him shed pounds. Now the reporter wrote, the man, quote, routinely takes the trainer on his vacations, calls him brother, and says, quote, I'll drag him with me when I need to see property in Miami or Las Vegas. When I go on vacations and he's not there, it's hard for me to get motivated. And then it isn't just individuals that are doing outsourcing. We read, final example here, from Smart Money, again August, it's just last month, of developers selling us instant small towns in Harbortown, Tennessee, or Urban Village, Las Vegas, with white picket fences and shop-filled town squares. These are residential theme parks into which people move. So what we might think of as kind of historically situated and developing organically, naturally over a period of years is now promised. Some of these communities are ecologically minded, we might like them, and others more upscale, commercially minded, but they're in any case instant. So without quite calling it that, the press, journalists, have begun a kind of a commercial edge beat. And most of these stories are told with kind of bemusement, as if, well, this is really offbeat and amusing and far out. On the other hand, perhaps not so far away, not so far out, perhaps a coming thing. So what are we to make of this? Today I'd like to share with you an ongoing research project I've been engaged in, interviewing service workers who do kind of emotionally personal work. Now this includes the staples of nannies and elder care workers. By the way, these people are extraordinary, the ones I've interviewed, I've slightly fallen in love with. Life coaches, personal assistants, birthday party planners, wedding planners. There are people that will come into your house and arrange your ancestral photographs. there are people who will sort out the items in your closet. And there are people, I interviewed a man who ran a launch off of Long Island Sound, and he distributed ashes of the deceased for poor families. So my question here, I've been interviewing both the people that do this service, the people for whom the service is done, that is the people who hire the service, and those in the case of children and elderly on whose behalf it is done. So three kind of moments in each case, insofar as I can. At its most narrow, I want to ask, what is it that's being outsourced? How common is it? How new is it? And in the broadest sense, I want to explore the implications of outsourcing for our most intimate life and to understand what it does for our understanding of social class relations, our understanding of gender relations, and most of all, our understanding of the emotional labor of capitalist man. I'm interested in the self that we seem semi-consciously to be developing to live in modern day free market capitalism. My hunch is that we're doing a great deal of emotional work without quite knowing we're doing it, kind of trying to sort out how the market intervenes in our most personal relationships and the signals we give. I care for you. I love you. This is where I'm stationed vis-a-vis you. I love you less. I love you more. I love you this way or that way. There's a pause in my love. We say these things. We are relational. We are not automatons. We are every day signaling our emotional connection to other people. And the market, the encroachment of the market, has altered the way in which I believe we do this. So I am sharing with you tonight a very broad brush, very speculative kind of take, and my best take on where it is I think we're going with this. In a sense, you could say that my current research is circling back to a book I wrote 20 years ago called The Managed Heart, The Commercialization of Human Feeling, which was about how we, in a sense, buy and sell emotions at work. We do emotional work. But now I'm turning around and looking at not the productive sector, but the consumption sector. I seem to be bumping into all these microphones. Italian, I guess. So that's what we're doing here. To give you a flavor of the thing, let me tell you a little about a recent interview I did with a life coach. This was a 25-year-old woman who did for $100 for 50-minute or 60-minute sessions, either over the telephone or a meeting in coffee shops at Starbucks, to help people achieve their goals. Life coach. And she, by the way, went to coaching school and was being coached as she coached. infinite regress, I'll have to follow that one out. And I asked her, her name was Susan, if things ever went wrong, how did they go wrong? And that turned out to be an important question to ask. She told me this story, and I'm quoting from her. I coached a female pastry chef who was seeking work at the Four Seasons Hotel. This is a very upscale hotel in the United States chain. But she was very negative, and she didn't get along with people very well. And with me, she was very passive, the pastry chef. She thought I was the doctor and she was the patient. So what she felt was, I'm sick, you fix me. I'll be passive, you be active. And when she didn't get the job as the pastry chef at the Four Seasons, she wanted me to fix the situation. I told her I didn't want to continue coaching her. And she replied that I wasn't doing my job well to make her dream come true. I was wimping out. You know this expression? It's like a macho thing. You're being girlish and weak. You're wimping out. She was also angry that I required that my clients have a positive attitude toward life. And I do require that. I told her that it wasn't my job to fix her life or live her life for her. And as a life coach, my job was to help her live her best life. Then I gave her a referral to a therapist. She got mad and hung up. Well, this raises a very kind of important issue of the ghost-written life, and that applies to many of the other services that I'm looking at here. So how we can ask, first of all, some basic questions. This seems very oddball, but on the other hand, how common are these services? A Google search, and you can do this yourself, for personal coach got 8,900,000 hits. Internet dating service, of course, 28,000. Personal assistance, 25, sorry, not thousand, million. Personal assistance, 25 million. Thank you, letter writers, 8 million over that. Anger management, 2 million. Something wrong there. There should be more anger management. Marital counselor, I just got 2,600,000 for that. Party animators. There are people that go to the party and animate it. I interviewed a woman in New York who went to bar mitzvahs, and there were all these 14-year-olds, you know, with braces on their teeth and kind of very shy. And so she was 25, and she was a good dancer, and she kind of turned the music up, and hey, you know, she'd get the 14-year-old going, hey, we're having a good time, and she kind of get it all going. She was really good at this, and it was a better party, and then the mothers would compete with each other to get that particular animator for their son's bar mitzvah. So what do these look like? I mean, how far out is this? Let me give you some examples that one sees, at least in the United States. All right. Now, can you see that? So you don't just buy a Valentine, which is already a commercial. There's so many layers of commercialization. I mean, we all live in a market life. There's just, you can't, these Post-its I bought, you know, everything is market. But within it, there are, you know, 10 or 7 layers of marketization. So you can buy a Valentine, but you can have a customized Valentine poem read. And Here it says, you provide the subject and the general message. I'll take care of the rest. Now we're back to the ghost-written kind of moment here. Your Valentine will be quite pleased. $30 for each poem. Order more than one and receive a discount. All right, this is a case of a particular act. So it's not a whole relationship you have with the person, but just you just want that Valentine. Okay, here's another. An ad for a personal assistant. Now, very often, the appeal is to your busy, harried life. You are in a time bind. You don't have time to do many things. I will take off your shoulders the things you don't want to do, the quantity time type things, so that you will have time to do what you do want to do, which is quality time. Well, in this one, it says, it's not well written, these are real, these are real. So it speaks of your scattered life amidst a busy society. And this person offers to be a travel support center, to accompany and arrange daily walks, arrange is capitalized, and to offer to make personalized greeting cards and to arrange all family photo albums, treasured memory profile, and to help locate long lost... Is this Alice in Wonderland, or is this, you know, it's really on the edge here. Long lost family members and loved ones, or people who used to be loved ones. Then we have for your pet. People have taken the quantity time things off. Now the things you want to reserve time for are quality time things. This person offers to take quality time activities off your hand. So are you too busy for quality time with your pet? I will give quality time to your pet. And moving up the evolutionary scale, we have... a companion for the elderly who will spend quality time with your elderly family member. All right. And now here's a man. Who offers a therapeutic talk and walk for women. Hello, I'm a handsome, intelligent, loving man who will take you on a 1 hour through a beautiful Tennessee Valley area. I am spiritual, insightful, wise, and caring. Share with me what's on your mind, what's going on in your life. I will share thoughts, wisdom, and try to shed some light for you. You'll have my... undivided attention. I welcome being close to the, he made a Freudian slip, me. And for this you pay $40. Holding hands while we walk and more. All right, and we have a kind of online therapy, which actually begins here. Healthy responses in a dysfunctional society. Now, what this is a... It's called, actually, this is what it is. It's called Rent-A-Friend. Rent-A-Friend. Get a lengthy personal response about your situation. Ever have a day when you just needed to vent to your good friend and get their feedback just to give you another perspective or to validate your thoughts or to tell you that you really are full of... What happens if you didn't have the energy to do the other side of the friendship? Where you listen to and support them in their struggle. And suppose you were starting to feel like their solutions would fit them but not you. That's when you need me to be your rent-a-friend. Shortly into seeing my very first therapist in the mid-1970s, I figured out that this was, it's a long series it sounds, what he was doing for me, and I coined the phrase. I've since, seen it in several other occasions, but I consider it to be mine, she says. Okay, then most interesting of all to me is down here, where we have a fee for series, for service that varies by length and complexity of your situation and question. Short and sweet is $50. Average is $75. Complex is $100. Now, what's an example of short and sweet? Hold your hat. This is Rent a Friend, short and sweet. I'm glad to see your site for questions and answers. My husband died of a heroin overdose in April, his second go-round in 5 years with it. But is it normal for me to be so pissed off at him for such stupidity? I mean, he was a pro. How could you accidentally OD when he had so much practice? I loved my husband dearly and had always been able to separate the junkie from the man. And I have maybe forgiven the man, but can't forgive the junkie for stealing my whole life away. I don't feel like I've done much mourning. No service, no funeral, just had him cremated and brought him home. Didn't want to have to rehash the drug thing a million times as a pro. Is this normal? It's funny, but it's sad. So that's the short and sweet. And then it goes from there. There's one about a woman who is, this is the average one, who found herself addicted to Paxil, which is an addictive drug she got from her doctor. And the final one is of a woman whose live-in boyfriend has wants to take care of the children of his ex-wife, and who's very attached to them, and he was part of their lives when they were very young. And this woman who's asking, calling Rent-A-Friend, is saying, well, you know, these aren't his biological children. It's this pathological that he wants to be part of their lives. So she says, very sensibly, no. All right, so oops. We're moving on to Rent a Dad. Notice there's kind of a rhetorical use of family here. This is it seems to me new. And he looks a little clueless, I have to say. And here's a dad or husband for rent or lease. This is all done with humor, but using the rhetoric of family and family roles. And not just dad, but there's rent a mom, a company with a heart for families. There are a great number of these. And I interviewed a woman asking her how she started a group called Rent a Mom, and she said, well, you know, I was married to a man who didn't appreciate what I did, and we divorced, and then I figured, well, if he didn't appreciate it, I might as well get paid for it. That's a form of appreciation. So she went over the commercial wall in search of some appreciation for what she's doing. Finally, The New Yorker, which really has runs a series of jokes which play to the commercial edge. I don't know if any of you are aficionados, as I am, of New Yorker humor, but this is one of mail order moms, which offer to be a different, it's like moms are theme parks. You actually can pick a certain kind of mom. This first one says, what a mom who will let you stay up as late as you want, who'll let you watch anything on TV. I'm waiting, box 7,291. Or at the bottom, here's an example, no rules, anything goes. After all, it's your life. Just say the word and I'm yours. Or here's one. I'll stay home and play games with you all day long. Donkey Kong, Rummy, whatever. No life of my own for me. I'm here. Where are you? Finally, this is from the other side, from someone who is looking for a mother. And I think this says a lot. Can I rent a mother? I feel like I just want someone to stay with me and tell me I can do it, and that I'm not alone, and that everything is going to be okay. We could just hang out and drink tea or watch television or go shopping. But she could tell me those things over and over, all day long, as many times as I need to hear it. I found that one very, very moving. All right. What it suggests is kind of what's on offer on one side and what's being sought and yearned for on the other. So, since time is short, I'm going to try and summarize the next question, which is, how new is this? I think it's new and it's old. In one way, what we're seeing here is a throwback to a village life where the resources of the outer community were as often drawn on to create an intimate life. So let's take our man who outsourced his life to India, Mr. Jacobs. If he were living in a village, he might, to find a mate, go to the matchmaker. He might, in his mourning, go to the minister. If in personal crisis, if he was yearning to for reassurance, he would go to a family member or a neighbor. There would be a lot of moving out of the intimate, nuclear family to create a life. But as Pugliani tells us in The Great Transformation, there was a kind of an organic, pre-rational, kind of relational web within which these exchanges took place. So in a way, what we're seeing is a kind of a throwback to village life. But what we're adding to it are two things. One is an ideology of privacy, of individualism, and a kind of a notion that there is a family that is a haven in a heartless world, and there's a notion that private life is separate from public life. Back in the village, private life was not that private. So what we're adding, number one, is kind of an ideology of privacy. Maybe on television you see pictures of a seaside cottage by the ocean as kind of this fantasy of separation and isolation. And secondly, we're adding to it a new kind of commodification that's highly rationalized. And, you know, if things are broken down and have different prices depending on the severity of your problem, we're really talking about a different, more rational, more modified, more calculated, more calibrated, sliced and diced form of commodification. So something old and something new. We are, as old in the old time, kind of using the resources of the outer culture to do our inner life, but we're doing it in a kind of a postmodern, highly rational market, and we're applying to it the expectation that there is a private life separate from public life. So what are we to make of this? Let me put forward some propositions. First, I think the market has, over the last 300 years, liberated us, especially women. We would not be women speaking of women, educated, voting, members of the public sphere, participants, without industrialization, without the market. And this goes for men too. I mean, the family used to be the whole show, and the market, in a way, makes us less dependent on the market, on the family. Less dependent, first of all, on the extended family, and then less dependent, indeed, on the nuclear family. So it's freed us, it's liberated us. But I'd like to guide your attention to the fact that, paradoxically, the market has also got us more dependent on it. The market makes us need it. Indeed, the market has an interest in making us need it, so that we're freed and also not freed. And it does this, unfreeing, with both a carrot and a stick. With the stick, the market, the workplace, robs us of time. More and more family members work, and in the United States, and I know Great Britain, the hours of work have gone up. So time is being sucked out at one end. And we're forced to do our private lives, to hire people to help us do our private lives. So that's the stick. And then there's also a carrot, that the market promotes a culture of shopping in and of itself as a source of kindness, love, happiness, quite apart from any one thing you buy. It promises, indeed, a life more personal, more authentic, more meaningful than the one we can do on our own. In other words, when we outsource activities, we focus on the activity we're not doing that we're paying someone else to do. But at the same time, something else is coming in. And that is the very idea, the concept of salability of life. And I think we can talk about being in a kind of a new cycle. Here I'm taking off from Juliet Shore, whose work I think is just terrific. I refer you to her work. And this is, in a way, a development of an idea of a cycle. I think first what happens is that there is kind of a depletion of family and community life. Jürgen Habermas talks about the life world getting smaller and the system world getting larger. So on the one hand, there's kind of we have less time for life at home. Robert Putnam in Bowling Alone tells us that people spend less time talking to each other. They visit less. There is altogether less interaction going on in the communal family sphere. In the United States, half of families watch television while they have dinner, and a quarter of them watch television while they have breakfast. So we have kind of a, and then you have the government kind of downsizing its supports for family life. So it's kind of a depletion story, which leads, I would suggest, to a kind of a nostalgia for yesteryear. The family, the community, the village we once had. Kind of a looking backward to an idealized vision of family life. And then at the other end, the market circles around and it sells us that back, piece by piece. And there's a de-skilling that goes on. On the one hand, I think the heart of emotional life is feeling recognized. I recognize you. I hear your whole story. I hear the parts of you in your story. You do that for me. There is a kind of a story exchange. It doesn't go on at one particular moment, but through time. And in a way, we've gotten de-skilled. We do that less well. We turn to television, have this sort of borrowed family. look at how they do it. So there's a kind of a de-skilling which, again, makes us need and look for someone who's a real expert. We can call it the takeaway buyback cycle. Capitalism creates problems on one hand and sells us the solution to them on the other. This leads to a kind of a totalism. You know, people used to talk in the post-war periods of socialism as a big, you know, big brother. It's just this big takeover of life, and you have no private life of your own, and government is everything, and how dreadful, really. And Engels kind of promised us only this kind of worker bee dystopia. There was kind of no private life outside of your working and you know, being productive. And so we used to say, oh, how terrible. I remember just as a girl kind of reading my weekly reader in the public schools, you know, oh, well, this was just, public schools are not, you know, American public schools are like, you don't pay money for them. Anyway, and just folding my arms, oh, this was terrible, this was socialism, oh, just a terrible thing. But I wonder if we shouldn't ask ourselves whether we've gone from the frying pan to the fire. What kind of a total system are we in now? If we wake up at 5 o'clock, we get in the car, we commute an average of 28 minutes in the United States, many people much longer, because affordable housing is often away from place of work. And then we go to work, expanded work day. The United States is now the workaholism capital of the world. You come back, and then to recover from work, you watch television. And then on television, you see things advertised that you want at the mall. And then you go to the mall to get goods and services. There's a service mall as well, and then you paid some money out, and you owe it, so you're back earning it. And increasingly, community life outside of malls and workplaces is a little harder to find in the United States. We talk, that's the bad news. The good news is that we believe in checks and balances, at least with regard to governments. Know that the judiciary should be separate from the legislative and the executive branch. But we're not looking for checks and balances in the right place, which is between the life world and the system world, in Habermas's terms, between a kind of informal family communities outside of the market and the market itself, the expanding market itself. Now, this takeaway sellback cycle has a curious class obscuring function. Certainly not everyone has $100 or $200 to burn to hire a life coach. And the poor indeed stick to family and kin to make their intimate lives. But the upper end of the first world is putting, I believe, this life market blend front and central into American culture and extending a paradox. The paradox is that the ideology of our private life has less and less to do with the reality of it. And for the upper stratum, this reality becomes a team-made man, a public home, and a system of purchased merit, while we believe in the self-made man, the private home, and the meritocratic world. Commercialization of intimate life extends, I would argue, a meritocratic disguise over a growing gap between rich and poor. And it legitimates that gap by saying, in essence, that the guy on top got there by pulling himself up by his own bootstraps. And if Mr. Jacobs can rise to be manager of Esquire magazine, and get all that many things done, his theater tickets bought, his email answered and the like, then you poor slob, why can't you do that? So there is the implication that if Mr. Jacobs is not lonely, he's getting his work done, he's able to do all these things, what deficiency in the rest of us is leading us to be less effective than he? That is, the whole individualism bootstraps kind of argument has increasingly more to disguise, and it does so through the idea of merit. There's a conundrum for women, too. So not only is this, I have a class-disguising effect, there's a kind of conundrum for gender as well. More than men, I would argue, the market has liberated women. But the takeaway sellback cycle has done nothing to bring men into the action at home. It has not liberated women from what I called in the second shift a stalled revolution. And women are still seen as the one who makes the haven in the heartless world a true haven, home. So if this haven, this home, comes to seem bought, comes to seem fake, comes to seem inauthentic and alienated, she is left holding the moral bag. It's kind of hers to do, and it's badly done, so maybe it's her fault. So those are the implications for our understanding of social class relations and our understanding of gender relations. What are the implications for the self, for our emotional life? I would like to argue here that we do a certain emotion work of capitalism. And we do it first by stationing ourselves somewhere in the market-non-market divide. For example, a child has a birthday. And there are many ways of saying to a child, look, I care about you, I've thought about you, I want to celebrate your birthday. One way would be on the production side of things, and a parent would say, well, I will make the cake, and it will be just the kind of cake you like, and that will represent my, I care about you. I will signal through doing this cake, making this cake well, not burning it, that I care for you. Or, for busy parents these days, a parent could say, well, look, I don't quite have time to make a cake, and if I made it, it wouldn't be that good, but Just Desserts down on Church Street has a wonderful chocolate cake, and I will pick up the phone and I will order the Just Desserts chocolate cake because I know that's just the kind of cake you like, and you and I will go down and we'll pick it up together. So that would be on the market side. Or taking it one further, you call up the party planner, who says, don't worry about ordering the cake. I'll order the cake. And I will blow up the balloons, and I will send out the invitations, and I will help you with the thank you cards for the gifts, and take care of the cake. I will write on it, you know, happy birthday, Junior. And that would be carrying it one step further. So, and you can base your meaning. I think we're living in a world of slippy, slidey, kind of gliding symbolisms, and we're symbolizing and re-symbolizing I love you, I care you, from one side of the market divide to the other. So you can say, Junior, I love you, and I'm thinking about you, either by making the cake, or by buying the cake, or by earning the money so that you can buy the cake. All of those can be sources of a gift in a gift exchange. So we station ourselves, given our market ideology, one place or another, in the way we want to give gifts in a gift exchange. But the way we station ourselves may not, on the sender side, may not correspond to the recipient's side. So in one interview I did, a mother kind of worked very hard and hired this party planner, and the child felt felt depressed and sad. "Mom, you don't want to, you know, spend time with me, and we could plan this together. Why are you hiring somebody?" So what was meant as a gift was not received as that. I've heard things on the other side, too. There was a respondent who lived in a very upscale neighborhood, and she wanted just to have a regular birthday party, you know, with five people, and you make the cake yourself. And in came these little children who had expected party planners and said, "Well, where's the itinerary?" And she said, "Can I help you, dear?" You know, "Well, no." "And where's the coordinator?" "Coordinator? No. I'm the coordinator." So there can be glitches one way or another. And we do, I think, often not say either market or not. We do ratioing. A gift is partly produced and partly consumed. Even stores do this. They sell you cakes that are 90% baked, or everything except the frosting. And then they sell you the frosting and the froster. So it's totally made, and then you yourself, you know, put on in your handwriting kind of the frosting. And there are stores now that sell you dolls, which you go to the store to make. So in the consumption sphere is a production side. There are these teddy bears that basically are just empty bags. So you pick the empty bag and of your choice, and then you go and it gets stuffed. And you go to the stuffer. But while you're stuffing it, you get a little red heart to put in, and then you kiss the heart, and some overworked poor soul who has to put the heart in 1,000 teddy bears, you know, and put it in the stuffing and stuff it, and then, you know, wishes you well with your very own heart-kissed teddy bear, and then they register the bear at the store. So it's like a doctor's office, you know, born in Macy's, you know, May 3rd. So don't think stores and commercial interests don't have a great interest in kind of help you ratio market, non-market meanings. Now, okay, here's getting a little more sad. Someone once said about my work that I never finish until I make someone cry. They said about Barbara Ehrenreich, my co-author on The Global Woman, that she never finishes until she's made someone laugh. So, in outsourcing, we have three parties. You know, one who is paying for service, one who is providing the service, and one on whose behalf the service is done. And I've interviewed a family that hired a Catholic Filipina elder care worker to care for their aging mother who lived in a distant city. And the worker and the Filipina worker and the mother had come to love each other very much. And in fact, the Filipina was very warm and very expressive, and she would give the mother back rubs, which, you know, was very normal, nice thing, and she, in a way, kind of saw this, her client, as kind of a motherly figure. And sometimes she would even climb into bed with the elderly person. The elderly mother loved this Filipina worker very much, saw her something as a child. And when it came to the mother's last hours, the adult children came from far away city and for a week spent a vigil with their mother during this time. And during this time, it became apparent to them how attached the Filipina was to their mother. And the Filipina was Catholic, would kiss the mother and place her hands and bless the mother to send her to help her on her voyage to heaven. And this, the man of the two, there were siblings, middle-aged siblings, who were witnessing this, the man said, you know, actually, my mother is an agnostic. She was a Unitarian. You know, she doesn't believe in heaven, and this isn't really for her, you know, that you're doing this. It's more for you. And there came a terrible moment where he said, look, I've hired you, and you're just paid, and please don't put your hands on my mother's face. But he felt very badly about that. And his sister, who was the one I interviewed, felt very badly about this. And the Filipina felt very badly about this. So so what are we learning here? We're learning here that people aren't automatons. The people you outsource activities to have hearts too. We are all, in this rationalized world, highly heartful. And there's a, you know, there are these tit-for-tat exchanges, but, you know, the tit gets smaller and the tat gets bigger. Things change. And there, on the underside of these exchanges, there are very important emotional meanings. And sometimes they can become estranged. I'll give you another example of a man who was hired to distribute ashes. I told you this briefly. Of the deceased. And three quarters of the times, the people that he did this for were there in the launch. But in a quarter of the times, the people for whom he was hired to distribute the ashes of the deceased for were not able to be there. And I asked him, well, what did you do when the clients weren't present? He said, well, it made a difference. If the kin were there, I had the ashes in a box, and I would put them in an urn, a very beautiful urn, which I would put on some brocade cloth that I was put on a table. And it would have a moment of reflection. Then I would take the urn, I would throw some nasturtium blossoms over the side, and I would pour the ashes over. And everyone was very pleased with this. And I said, well, what happens when they aren't there? He said, well, since they aren't there, I have the ashes in the box, but I don't need the urn, and I don't need the cloth, and I don't need the table. And I just take them, but I put the nasturtium blossoms over the side, and then I pour the ashes into the water. And I asked him, I said, does that have a, you know, the people that had lost the person weren't able to feel the sacredness of it, but did you? Is that why you put the nasturtium blossoms? And he said, no, actually, the nasturtium blossoms tell me which way the water is going. And so the ashes won't get on the boat. I think we can talk about the possibility of estrangement and alienation in cases like this. So there is market life. I could say many things, but market life faces us with the task of figuring out what the feeling rules are. What is it we should feel? Of coordinating feeling rules so that what you want the other person to understand as your gift is what the other person does understand as your gift. And then there are the poignant stories of people kind of lifting their feeling to fit. And what I think we're looking at here is how capitalized, in a way, we are in ourselves. We attach our whole selves to whatever we do. As the saying goes, wherever you go, there you are. Even the most trivial commercial actions are likely to have some transference between service provider and customer. So, just as an ideology of individualism disguises how relational we are, I think we can say that an ideology of rational tit-for-tat capitalism disguises the everyday emotionality, such as we've seen in some of these examples. So to conclude, we're already living, I would submit, on the commercial edge. We are not living in a pre-modern village. We're not living in a mid-century haven in a heartless world. We're living in something that's its own new thing, a throwback to the village using the ideology of individual privacy, but in a hyper-capitalized context. And life on the commercial edge raises large and very serious questions, especially if the United States is to be kind of the mega model, God help us, for the rest of the world. These are even larger and more serious questions than they would be otherwise. The growth of market life and the atrophy of life outside it, questions about the extension of a meritocratic disguise for growing class differences, and questions about the moral bag women are left holding when impersonal life encroaches into the home. And most of all, it leaves us with questions about the degree to which we develop a capitalist self with capitalist needs in a capitalist world. Let me end there.
Thank you very much, Ali. Those of you who have to relieve your hired babysitters, please leave now. We haven't actually rented any audience animators, but I'm sure there'll be plenty of questions. We have microphones both downstairs and upstairs. I think we have people from many different countries here today. So one issue perhaps is how global is this phenomenon? Is the US the harbinger of the future for everyone else? And this is a city which also includes many things you haven't mentioned, like speed dating, several tens of thousands of prostitutes, doulas used for birthing, and so on. So who would like to kick off? We've got several questions. Who's got the microphone up there? Perhaps the lady in the white shirt there, and then several down here. Just there.
Thank you. Could you please tell us, is this working? A couple of things more about this research, whether it was done only in the States and who the families were. Because I think if you look in transnational families, the situation changes a lot. Or if you look, let's say, at studies about consumption in Eastern Europe or in Russia, let's say work done by Caroline Humphrey, you see that how kinship ties have started to get like even stronger than they were before the fall of communism, because people are deprived even more of means of survival. So it's like I would say the reverse process is going on in very, in different parts of the world. So just if you could be more specific about the research which on which this lecture was based. Thank you.
Should we take two or three?
Okay, let me just write this down. Yeah.
And right at the back there. Yeah. No, behind you.
I'm just wondering, in your remarks, Professor Shield, you didn't seem disposed to use your observations as a critique of the market economy or capitalism. But isn't the commercialization of intimacy, things you've drawn attention to, the fact that we are now increasingly being asked to pay for things from the pay for things that we would at one time have received from spouses or family members or friends. Isn't that a consequence of the system of property ownership that is conventionally supposed to underlie a market economy? In a market economy, everyone is ascribed a private account, and they're supposed to work to maximize the returns to that private account. That's their whole raison d'etre. And in such a world, there can't be tokens of intimacy. There can't be disinterested social contact. Everything has to be a transaction. And isn't the move to the commercialization of intimacy a recognition of that fact?
Let's take one more lady in the white shirt.
My question is, what could be the consequences or the result of this process on society and people on the long term? That's it. Thanks.
What are the consequences of it? Where is it going? Okay. Okay. Result.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. Well, the first question was, could I locate my research? What would I have to say about, for example, Russia, where the market is receding, it fails, and there is a return to the gift exchange in a kin system? I think that's an excellent point. I'm talking really about the United States context, where the market is not weak, and we have a state that's trying to, you know, expand it and globalize it. And I think what your remark is very helpful in making us remember is that markets don't expand everywhere and have some evolutionary kind of goal. There's they can recede. If we look at Africa, for example, you know, the market is, I guess it has, 4% of world trade. That we need to situate it here. And indeed, my husband and I spent some time in Russia, where very often there was a kind of it's interesting, all these sort of 100 little trays of food on the tiny table and exchanges of vodka, and it was as if there was a kind of a symbolic by ritual affirmation that went with a very complex distribution of goods and services. So so-and-so would have cheese from one place, and so-and-so else would have, you know, biscuits from another, and there would be shoes from somewhere else, and there were many, quote, market functions absorbed by a very ingenious kin system. I came away thinking that this is a brilliant kin system, but inside people's briefcases often there was bread and peanuts. It wasn't actually work. This was in the early 90s. So on the second point, property ownership, isn't there a kind of a set of premises that have to do with private ownership and individualism, perhaps, that make real expressions of sentiment impossible? Actually, I don't think so at all. I think there is, this is captured in Adam Smith's two books, one, Wealth of Nations, which was sort of premised on individuals that were separate from one another and making deals and, you know, had property and sort of had exchange relations with everyone. But then he had this other book, you know, The Philosophy of Sentiments, that talked about how we are hardwired to share with each other and kind of have caring relations to one another. And I think it was the introduction to the Sentiments book that talked about how odd it was that there were these two very different conceptions of man by the same author. But I think he had his finger on both sides of human nature, and that he was right that there are both. So I see, in fact, what feels like the problematic here is how, given that we are relating to one another and we do have empathic relationships to one another, how do we do it over and across a kind of market lines? That becomes what the problem is, because we're really trying to do both. The third question is the consequences. Where are we going? I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball, but I do believe that that there is a very powerful kind of desire on people's parts to form relationships with one another, to have full emotional lives. In other words, I think there is a lot of room for pushback and moments of resistance to all of this. So I'm not a gloom and doom person here at all.
Okay. There's one question right at the front here, then another one right at the two right at the front here, and another one there.
I've just been trying to rack my brain and try to picture any time in Western history, the history of Western civilization, where among the class of people that can afford this type of thing, this hasn't been the case. I mean, whether it's Mary Poppins the nanny or Jeeves the butler, or, you know, down from the king to Caesar to Pharaoh, if you can afford the grievers and the party planners and whatever else, generally they've done it, right? And it just makes me wonder whether this really isn't just a case of the affluence of society and whether that's really kind of the cause. It's, well, because people can afford it, right, is primarily what we're getting at. And that actually works very well with the geographical question that you had earlier, because I think that, you know, why is this happening where it is? And anyway, I was just wondering if you had any comments about that.
Okay, one at the front here. So it's the democratization of what the aristocracy always had.
Mm-hmm. I guess, in one sense, a similar question. Talking about spatial variation of this, because I think you rightly point out that, you know, the U.S. is an extreme example of what's happening. And certainly we see it here in England, but to a lesser extent. And I'm trying to understand and think about what's happening in the U.S. I think you're absolutely right to kind of think about the whole ideology of commodification and how shopping itself has been marketed as a pleasurable event, and all those sorts of things that are so important that part of the U.S. But it also strikes me that perhaps one of the things that you find in the U.K. is often people are less mobile, that they do stay in communities longer, and they do have more locally rooted mm-hmm. exchanges, and that in the U.S. that's often not the case. People are ultra mobile, and people often change jobs. You know, if you just look at mobility rates and labor markets and things, that it's much higher rates of labor market mobility, and often that is spread over space. And just wondered to what extent perhaps that's also kind of some of the push factor that might contribute to it.
That's very good.
Pass it to along. Uh-huh. Robert Putnam says the UK doesn't have quite the same, well, anything like the same social capital problems as the US, for example.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I really enjoyed your talk. I was just wondering what your position is on Gary Becker's work as an economist. In the 70s, he came up with the idea that intra-family relations are entirely commercial transactions. This is going back to the gentleman's questions there. So the utility function includes things like feeling good about looking after your nan. This has been really disputed by economists because they blame the neoclassical methodology. And so I was wondering if your take was that economists have a dodgy position on emotions as things stand. But the reason I find that interesting is because the application is often in developing country situations. So, for example, why do poor couples choose to have children is often for extremely commercialized motivations, such as a lot of them may die off before they get a chance to look after you, et cetera, et cetera. And why do we not find that problematic? Is that really our bourgeois positionality?
And one more question there, third row.
I was just interested what your views were on this from a green perspective. because it seems to me that the commercialization of the human, authentic human experience is directly related to our increasing alienation from the natural world, which leads us to pursue an economic and therefore social system which is environmentally unsustainable over the, you know, the next 100 years or so. And I wondered what your thoughts were in the connection between your studies and sort of critiques of the contemporary economic system.
Great. Okay. The first question spoke to the question of how new is this? Is this a democratization of affluence that we've seen, 300, 400 more years ago? And I guess that my answer is to refer to the part of the lecture where I try to say what I think actually is new. It's true that Queen Victoria did not probably clip her own toenails. You know, someone else did, and they were recompensed for this. And it's also true that in the past there were forms of commodification we don't have now, like wet nurses, that actually give milk to infants. But what I tried to say it clearly, but what I think is new is the confluence of a kind of a throwback to using external resources to do our intimate life with a kind of an ideology that we have private cocoons that are separate, even though we have strangers now coming and going from our separate space, our individual spaces. And thirdly, I think the commodification itself is different in that it is more finely calibrated. I wonder if 300 years ago there would be a different price set for the content of the problem that a soothsayer is set to solve. So it's a researchable question, but my guess is there's something new here, although it draws on these old things. I think that the group of people I've mentioned are indeed a mixed bag, and some of it is affluence, if you're looking at butlers and the like, and some of it is a kind of a commodification born of desperation for time, the two-job family, the single-parent family that really needs help, together with helping the disabled, the aged, and the like. So I guess I don't agree that it's all the same old thing. The second was UK is a different story from the United States, and I think this is a conversation, actually, this gentleman that worked with New Society, Paul? Yes. You and I had a conversation probably, God knows how many years ago, 20, well, at least, maybe 30. About air hostesses, right, in the managed heart. And you said then, I can't imagine in Britain people being paid to smile. They... Yeah, nobody smiles. Right. That's right. Nobody smiles at all. Right. The paid-for frown. So, I think we do have, the United States is definitely more of a market takeover because the market is actually an ingenious thing, actually. I think capitalism is an absolutely brilliant system, and that it isn't an economic system, it's a cultural system, and that it moves where there are vacuums. And in the United States, we have this kind of highly brilliant functioning dynamic capitalist system and kind of many moments of vulnerability in private life, and the two have this kind of synergy that other societies don't have. But I'm just coming as the canary in the coal mine saying, look, if this is happening to us, heads up. The third question was, what do I think of Gary Becker? Well, Lordy B. I mean, I think he's highly reductive. And to think that to start with an economic theory and kind of impose it on people and to say that everything's actually a deal, it's the kind of thing, if that's the what you theoretically posit, then you can go and count it and see it. You know, but I don't think that's what we should posit. I think we are mammals. Before neo-economics was invented, I mean, we had social lives, and those lives were not simply ones of aggression and fighting, a Conrad Lorenz thing, and they weren't just lives of kind of a sexual congress, a la Freud. These were lives of caretaking. I think that, you know, human beings have infants which are helpless for a long period of time, and that we have developed kind of empathy, that the animals that survived were ones that could really tell what that infant was signaling, and we've generalized it, that we are empathic creatures, I believe. This is what I believe, and that we are, and I start there. I really start there. What kind of economic systems do to that? What do cultural systems do to that? What does economic scarcity do to that? So I just think he sets us off on the wrong path. You know, there's this weird tradition in sociology on altruism. Totally reductive. It starts with the question of why would it be true that people would sacrifice for one another? You know, what an interesting problem. Why would they do that? You know, how irrational. Well, I would turn that around. Why is it they wouldn't to a degree? So that's what there. And the green perspective, tremendously important. I think the implication of this kind of time bind, nostalgia, sell it back piece by piece, back into the time bind cycle that I believe we have gotten into, is a kind of a system that is not sustainable, either socially, and it leads us to gobble up many resources, not just physical, but emotional. So I think it's a wonderful question, and it is an implication that that makes this whole thing urgent.
Okay, we've got time for just a few more questions. Paul, did you want to ask one? They're just along from you, and then two right at the back there. If you wait for the mic.
Glad, Ali, that you said you didn't know where we were going, because at one point you seemed very pessimistic in a Frankfurt School sort of way, that all these pleasures were our trap, really, and we'd never get anywhere. But I just wanted to raise the question of fantasy in all this, because it seemed to me that quite a lot of the things you put up on the screen were a shared, or in some cases a non-shared, fantasy by the person putting the ad in, rather like the things you see in the partner search columns of magazines and newspapers. And given the fact that we're talking about California to an extent, I was reminded of Nathaniel West's novel, Miss Lonely Hearts, which entirely turns on this kind of plea and a fantasy about your real self. Whether it really is a market, I wonder. It's a liberating a fantasy in a psychological, even a psychiatric sense. But how much of it is really a market? And how much of it, even in the United States, is really detached from family in the old sense? I don't want to regard fiction as reality, but then what is reality, really? And, you know, on the one hand, we have Nathaniel West and and perhaps the novels about losers of Elmore Leonard, a lot of whose language was very similar to this. But on the other hand, you have Ann Tyler carefully chronicling family life in Baltimore in all its aspects, and it doesn't strike me as that different from family as it always was. So where does fantasy fit into the market?
Could you pass the mic along four places?
Well, actually, my question quite neatly comes on from that. It's like the dichotomy which seems to be going on here between the false and the real. I mean, there seems to be a lot of element. If you're going to have someone at a party, you know, and pay them to be there, obviously they're not really at the party, but when they're there, they have to be a real, you know, they have to be involved and they actually become a real person. Your example of the Filipino woman looking after the elderly woman, they're a real relationship forms there.
Right.
But in a sense, it's not real because it only can exist within one forum. Say as a care assistant going along to give care to someone, say between 9 and 10 in the morning every day, they have a forum where the interaction must be real, but outside of that 9 to 10 time space, there shouldn't be any more interactions really, unless, you know, real friendships are formed and stuff like that. So what I'm kind of getting at is the fact that there can't be any balance there. We can't have a balance between the real and the fake. You can't, on one hand, kind of be someone's friend and not be, but that's what we're saying you are. Because if the transaction isn't real, then it doesn't exist. If you feel that the person isn't being, you know, isn't being real with you as a friend, then you wouldn't buy it, in a sense. So that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
Two at the very back.
Yeah. I would just simply like to point to women outsourcing child rearing as an example that is dramatic by being omitted completely from your talk. Most of your examples have actually referred to men using these services, occasionally women offering them. But it seems to me that there's almost nothing that you are talking about that couldn't already be discussed in relation to the rise of childcare in the Western world. And yet it seems to me this particular example has been avoided by all social scientists because of this feminist discomfort with the fact that a lot of children, their real mothers are not the mothers who gave birth to them. They're just the women who are paying for some other woman, or usually a sequence of women, to prevent the child actually developing an attachment to any of their nannies or childminders. And there's this sort of blank space around the whole issue of commercialized childcare in the Western world. And you have also chosen not to bring it into the discussion.
Okay, and one last question up there. Yeah.
Hi, Ali. Just going to make a few comments quickly to this last one. Slightly important one. I know that within ethnic groups, I know that other family members are also take care of other people's children as a matter of recourse to duty. I noted within the societies that you were mentioned discussing, you talked about societies where it's known that working hours increase and slavery has been abolished. My question slightly...
Sorry, I couldn't understand that.
I noted within the societies that you were discussing, it's slavery has been abolished for definite, and the working hours of people have increased, so there becomes a market for, commercialized intimacy. The question that I have is, this market, could we not interpret it in another way? And that is as a form of deviancy. In every society or every social interaction is governed by social norms with people that we really can't choose. But here we can choose about the people that we want to have social interactions with. However, isn't that a form of deviancy in a way? For instance, I could rent a mother and I could terminate her contract when I have to look after her in her old age, that kind of thing, you know, where I'm not held accountable for those kind of things. Isn't that surely a new form of deviancy against existing social norms?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, my head is swimming here. Very, very good issues. Paul was raising this issue of the selling of fantasy. I think that's a wonderful comment, and it is when an extension of the idea that you don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle. And here you don't just sell a service, you sell kind of the excitement of it, the magic of it. And this is, in fact, all about a kind of, I think, emotional magic. I think the fantasy is often one of being in a way unconstrained by the norms this last speaker was talking about, that you can have a friend without being a friend, you know, that you can have a wife without being a husband, be a husband without being, having, without dropping the obligations. You know, what would that be like? If my part of the deal was simply to pay money, then I wouldn't have to do these other things. And I think capitalism is, again, brilliant at elaborating fantasy, of giving you ideas you didn't have before. Like, there are architects that come into a home, speaking of upscale commercialization, and say, oh, this is a very nice home, but don't you really want to have an arch here? And, you know, the patio, it's all concrete. Don't you really want some nice steps here? And, you know, these bushes don't look so nice. Why don't you, wouldn't there be just poppies on the side or tulips? I mean, in other words, the person who comes in to actually simply build a house or refurbish a house does fantasy creation, does visualization, and that, of course, then by the end of the day, the client has said, oh, yes, that's a good idea, that's a good idea, that's a good idea, and the next cocktail party, they're claiming to have come to this themselves. So, yeah, fantasy is big. There was a this second question spoke to the relationship of fake and real, and seemed to argue that in a way it was one or the other. And I understand that I've struggled with this a lot. Because everything I do seems to go back to that question of what's boundaries between people and the authenticity or the image, the idea of authenticity that we hold to what we do. I think it's in reality often blurred. I think this Filipina really loved this older woman, and when her shift was over, she went home and she thought about that older woman. I think it was, you know, psychoanalytically call it a transference of her own, her love of her own mother onto this elderly patient, but it became something real in itself. She spent all her time with her. So it may start as fake and become real, or start real and become fake. That's more slippery than we'd like to imagine. It's a little troubling, or what's the word I want, kind of disturbing, you know, to not think of these as dichotomous, but in truth I think it's very complex. And I should say here where I am in a way, to locate my theoretical self in the commercialization literature, I would say that there are three kinds of literature. One are kind of the modernization theorists that say, well, there's kind of a steady march toward an ever more modern world, and I'm just looking at one version of that. And then there are people who are not evolutionists, but who look, for example, like Viviana Salazar, who looks at what I call the kind of cultural pageant of, you know, market and non-market life. She points out there's always been a market element to family life. We have allowances. We have, you know, divorce settlements. We have gifts. We have property transfers. There's always been money in the personal realm. And what's new, to go back to this person's question. My problem with her is that she's not looking at the overarching system of capitalism. I think there is a motor and an interest group that's pushing in one direction, and there can be things pushing against it, and there can be conditions which lead it not to work at all. But I think it's very important that we not just be macro, micro, but look at the overarching system where we're part of. And then there's the third group, are kind of the watch out for capitalism people. And I do actually group myself there, but I think they often are too materialist and don't look at emotions and feelings and see caring relations as basic. So that would how I locate myself, I guess. Thought I would just, that's not in response to any particular question, but I just thought I'd put that there. Third question was childcare. Why am I not talking about childcare? Actually, I wrote a book co-edited with Barbara Ehrenreich called Global Woman, which very much talks about childcare workers from the third world coming, leaving their own children behind to come and take care of the children and elderly in our homes. I refer to it as kind of a heart transplant, a form of not brain drain, but care drain. So it's not that I've avoided this question in my writing. Look at the commercialization of intimate life, for example. But here I don't, it's because elder care and child care are kind of a part of the normal kind of understanding of modern family life, I paid less attention to it than the fringe in this talk, because the fringe is a fringe, and fringes are interesting. I'm just like Freud kind of looks at crazy people to tell you about normality. I kind of look at the fringe to tell us about things that we take for granted. But I am, child care workers are part of my study. I went to the National Child Care Association meeting in Herndon, Virginia last year and interviewed a lot of them, where many of these issues were front and central for them. The final question is ethnic relations and, deviance. Do we see, in a way, the market encroachments, fascinating question, as kind of a way of getting out of taking care of your mother, for example, of just legitimating non-kin ways of relating to each other? I guess I agree that norms and culture are front and central to this whole story, and that we do need to pay attention to group differences in norms, and that one person's deviance is another person's normality. So this speaks to kind of situating our research in particular groups. So let me end with that.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Arlie, for such a fascinating lecture. Just perhaps one final thought. There is, in a way, a much bigger research agenda here around intimacy and how intimacy is organized. Some fascinating things happening in China. On the one hand, the one-child policy and what that has done to intimacy, and on the other hand, the legal requirements on children to look after their parents in old age, now very much under strain because of capitalism, urbanization, and so on. And this is also a territory which states are involved in, just one example of many in the world of states encouraging mentoring and personal advisors and so on. In the UK, the 100,000 people or so working in job centres were encouraged to have a much more intimate relationship with unemployed people. And that then became quite a problem as they became very involved in their lives, deeply engaged in their problems, and found it hard to, in a sense, negotiate the barriers. So there's a story about, say, the state's involvement in intimacy alongside perhaps the market's involvement, which is constantly being negotiated. If there are any life coaches in the audience, please leave your cards at the door. I assume you don't pay them for being research subjects, do you?
No.
So this could be your gift,
gift
to society to be a research subject. And could we all thank Arlie for a fascinating evening?